Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts as always on the weekend show as well as your hosts throughout the week featuring our daily editorials and company updates, trying to keep all of you as up to date as we can on U.S. equity markets, key news and data points, as well as what's going on in the resource sector and driving down into some of the even junior companies in the resource sector by talking directly to management. You can hear all of our interviews on our website, kereport.com. I'm sure a lot of you are tuning in simply on our website or on our podcast, Corlin Economics Report. We're kicking off this weekend show with one of my favorite guests, Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Advisory Group, also editor of the Book Report. Peter, let's start off with the key data point that came out this week, the CPI data. Inflation data for the U.S., the number came in at 7.5% increase from a year earlier. This was at the upper boundary of the 7 to 7.6% consensus range. And I think even more importantly is inflation continues to grow in the U.S., even as we keep hearing from some central bankers and a lot of other commentators saying inflation's going to start dropping or it's definitely topping out. Fact of the matter is, inflation is staying extremely elevated. Let's start off with your outlook for inflation, Peter. Where do you stand on all the inflation coming out of the U.S. that continues to surprise to the upside?
So I've been talking about this building inflationary environment and pressures intensifying since 2020. But I do think on a rate of change basis that the February or March prints that we'll see in the coming 2 months will be the peak. And then just by the math of tougher comparisons, that rate of change will slow. Therefore, the question is, if I'm right, where do we settle out at? Where, to what extent does it slow? Keep in mind that pre-COVID, inflation rates were call it 1% to 2% in the U.S. and call it globally. And that was a level of inflation that allowed central banks to do whatever they wanted to do and leverage to increase across the board in valuations and markets, whether it's bonds, stocks, or pieces of art or antique cars and so on, to inflate. I believe that inflation won't be getting back to that 1 to 2% level, certainly not this year, and I'll deal with next year. But I think a 3 to 4% rate is more likely. Now, if you break out inflation into its two components of goods and services, the service side will likely continue to accelerate, particularly because rents in the calculation of CPI are still dramatically undercounting reality. The government said that rents are up about 4% year over year, when according to apartmentlist.com, they're up 18% for new leases, or they were in 2021, and they're probably up about 8 to 10% for renewal of existing leases. So the government telling us that that inflation, or at least either whether it's owner's equivalent rent or rent of a primary residence, is up about 4%. It's not a very accurate measure. Now on the flip side, you have goods prices, which are now rising at the fastest pace since 1975. That should start to come down in its rate of change. Both because of, again, tougher comparisons, but also some modest signs that in the next couple of months, we'll see some easing on the supply side. We'll hopefully see some more semiconductors and more auto production and so on. I think net, when you bring them together, we're still going to be, as I said, settling in at a higher rate of gain. Again, even though we're going to be peaking within the next couple of months.
Well, Peter, I think there's a lot of inflation that's underreported in the way the government does the statistics. Because if you look at, like you mentioned, rents, but even the senior living care, healthcare expenses. If you go to the grocery store, I was just watching a piece where they showed so many food products up between 30 and 60%. So in a lot of people's daily life, it's hitting them a lot harder than what we're even seeing in the 7.5% in the CPI reading. But regardless of even if the inflation metrics do start getting disinflation and tapering down, is it possible that the Fed is starting so late in the cycle and where the yield curve is so flat already and they're so far literally behind the curve that even their policy effects from the first few hikes really aren't going to do much to tame inflation?
Well, the yield curve is flattening in response to what they think the Fed is going to do. So the Fed is just following what the bond market's already priced in. I mean, as of today, or today being Friday, I know this is over the weekend, but Jim Buller, who's a voting member of the Fed, said that he wants to have the Fed funds rate, he wants to raise it by 100 basis points by July 1st. Well, there's three meetings between now and July 1st, which implies that he wants to go 50 at one of those meetings. So now we have about an 80% chance that the Fed hikes 50 basis points in March. So the flattening is because of what they think the Fed is going to do. But it's also what usually happens in a rate hiking cycle is the curve flattens because they assume growth is going to slow. But what is interesting here is, yes, the curve is flattening, but rates across the board are going higher. So the 10-year yield at above 2% is, yeah, we have a flattening yield curve, but yields are going up across the board. And that means the average 30-year mortgage rate is now heading to 4%. So it's sort of a knockout across the board, where maybe in previous instances of Fed flattening, that the longer end yield didn't go up at the same time, like in the mid-2000s when the Fed was hiking and long rates stayed low. This time around, yields going up across the board, even though the shorter end's going up quicker than the longer end.
So, Peter, dealing with inflation, there's also the consumer side of things. And I've asked a number of people this, is the consumer is obviously getting squeezed here, although wages are rising. But fact of the matter is, and we're even seeing it in credit card debt is starting to increase. Actually, it started a number of months ago to increase. How can the consumer stay this, I guess, optimistic or spend this much money to keep inflation staying high when it seems like they are really getting squeezed across the board?
Well, if you look at the University of Michigan Consumer Confidence Index, that is at a 10-year low. So they're not optimistic. They're worried about this rising their cost of living relative to their wages. They're worried about falling real inflation-adjusted wages, and that their earnings are going less further than it did prior to this inflation bout. So that is certainly a cause for concern and a reason why, you know, economic growth will slow. And then you throw in, of course, the margin pressures and the higher labor costs on the corporate side, which either the company is going to try to offset it via price increases, or they're going to have to eat it via tighter profit margins. And that in a way potentially could slow growth too, because that disrupts expansion plans and so on. So I think net of all of this is that we're entering into a stagflationary type situation.
Well, Peter, that makes me think of, you know, the 1970s and the high energy prices, which we absolutely have. And aside from the high wages, the energy markets are also pressuring all companies. So whether it's freight or transportation, or it's just another silent tax on everything that slows down growth. Is it possible that the Fed is hiking these rates into a slowing growth period where it's actually going to potentially cause a recession in a year or two?
There's no doubt that they'll tighten us into recession, but I don't think keeping rates at zero is an alternative. I think that the Fed forgot the lesson learned in the 1970s is that you can't put employment growth ahead of inflation, because unless you have stable prices, you'll never have a healthy economy and full employment. So there is, I get your question is almost looking for, is there a way out? And there is no way out, because if they do nothing, then inflation just embeds itself and becomes a bigger problem. And if they do something, well, then growth is going to slow, markets will fall, and then we are in trouble too. So it is a pick your poison type situation. But as an entity that where stable prices are a key part of what they do, they need to get some credibility back, and they need to, you know, give us some positive interest rates again. We're certainly not going to get positive real interest rates at any point throughout this rate increase. So even if they hike 100 basis points or 200 basis points, real interest rates will still be negative. They'll still be considered easy. You know, prior to this time period, real interest rates used to be 3 to 4%. The Fed funds rate used to be 3 to 4% above the rate of inflation. And like I said, we'll be lucky if we get back to zero at some point. So yeah, there's going to be pain ahead, but I don't think that the alternative should be, okay, the Fed should just do nothing and have their fingers crossed that inflation falls, because, you know, we don't want to slow growth. But yeah, a lot of this inflation is because of the supply side, but the Fed and fiscal policy have been pedal to metal on the demand side.
Yes, they have been, but so has really the rest of the world for quite that time, especially after that COVID breakdown. Let's tie this a bit more into the markets too, because last year, pretty easy year for anyone invested in any of the indexes, as they all seem to just consistently go up week after week, month after month. However, once we turn the corner into 2022, and even a little bit before turning that corner for some of those high-flying tech stocks, we did start to see some weakness. And January actually was a pretty bad month for a lot of the broad averages, again, compared to what we saw in 2021. Now, it does make sense, right? Markets pull back when a lot of the free money, or at least some of it, is getting pulled away. But what is your outlook for these markets, Peter? Because as much as the markets have pulled back, they haven't been in a free fall.
I think what we've seen to this point is, and it really started last year and sort of spread out into the bigger names in January, was last year people started to question valuations, particularly starting last summer when the Fed said that they're talking about tapering. Because there's nothing like a monetary tightening cycle to make people pay attention to valuations. Whereas in the opposite, when money's flowing like the Colorado River, investors can be valuation agnostic. So what happens from here is, what does the economy do now? How does the economy respond to higher interest rates? How does the economy respond to wider credit spreads and lower stock prices? Because if there is a, which they will likely be, a negative economic impact, well, then you have falling multiples tied to falling earnings, and that creates a bigger problem.
Yeah, it's interesting, Peter, because just this last earnings season, there was a lot more focus put on valuations, something we hadn't heard in a couple of years, where valuations didn't matter. But what we're seeing now is a whole cadre of new investors that got into the markets and opened trading accounts in 2020 and 2021 when they're stuck at home. Many people decided not to go back to work and become traders. Other people just started investing for the first time. And markets had gotten really frothy. And as we've seen over the last few months, even before this year, the calendar turned over, the meme stocks got hit. Some of the Russell 2000 and small cap stocks got hit. The growth stocks got hit. And even the cryptos took it in the pants for a while. So there was a lot of investors that probably had a lot of capital wiped out, and this is their first bigger corrective move. Do you think it's possible that we won't see as much of the rotation from sector to sector, and that actually there'll be more hesitancy and maybe a little bit more volatility as some of that money went to money heaven and got evaporated? Do you think that that's going to affect just the way these markets behave moving forward?
Well, when you look at the retail investor, you know, if you think the bull market started in March 2009, it took them 12 years to decide to get involved. You know, the retail investor got blown up in 2000 to 2002. Then many of them switched to flipping homes in the mid-2000s and, you know, rode out 12 years of a bull market before they decided to start trading meme stocks through Robinhood. I think that a lot of those people are probably going back to their day job, and markets are going to go back to trading the way that it did beforehand, with less of this short-term trading mentality, get-rich-quick type investing, which is, it's actually really not investing. It's just speculating. But yeah, I think that some of those people that had a good month or two last year, they're probably not doing that anymore. And if they are, they're probably getting burned. So what that means to the broader trading, I don't know. I think the monetary tightening will lead to higher volatility regardless. I think people just need to be a lot more careful about the things that they invest in nowadays.
So, Peter, what's your overall assessment of general sentiment for at least some of the larger investors that you chat with? Not so much, I guess, negative on some of these growth stocks because the market's telling us that, but where they have maybe some confidence in terms of a longer-term investment or something that is a bit more stable. And let's be honest with ourselves, this different environment that we're going to have this year.
Well, I'll tell you what we're doing. I mean, I think you need to have a different playbook for the next couple of years. And what will work in the next couple of years will be different than what has worked over the past couple of years, or even the last 5 to 10 years. And that means not having as much exposure to the growthy parts of the market and technology, having more value, having more international markets. I mean, if you look at year to date, for example, two of the cheapest markets in the world are up this year. That's the FTSE in London, and that's the Hang Seng in China. We came in this year with both markets trading at about 10 to 11 times earnings with 3 to 4% type dividend yields. So there are ways of outperforming, but you know that trade didn't work for years, but now it's going to work. We know commodities have traded well, and that should continue to work, even though if the demand side gets hurt, that can be an issue, but the supply side is still very much constrained. So again, I think investors need to change playbooks if they're going to be keeping their head above water in this kind of a very difficult market that we're entering into.
Peter, what's your take on the precious metals market? Because a lot of people thought when we saw these higher inflation readings, that would actually be a boon for gold and possibly silver. We didn't see much of a reaction at all, kind of maybe more trending sideways in a channel, but it also hasn't fallen out of bed. And then the general narrative is that, you know, when rate hiking cycles start, that it's less attractive to be in gold. But then when we look historically, rate hiking cycles actually help gold. So a lot of people are puzzled, confused, not sure where to go. What's your outlook on the precious metals?
So we know that in this move that gold and silver topped out in, call it August of 2020. I think it's pretty fair to say that one of the reasons why it's so underperformed in 2021 is because of the belief either that, yeah, the Fed's right, inflation is transitory, or if they're wrong, well, the Fed's going to come to the rescue and save the day and stamp down on inflation. But I think what we learned is it's not transitory. And here we are printing a 7.5% CPI. And at least for the next month, the Fed is still buying assets and they will still have rates at zero. So I think that gold started to trade better really the day after the December FOMC meeting, even when the Fed said, yeah, we're going to double the pace of tapering, because people realized, man, they're really, really behind the curve here. And real interest rates are going to stay pretty negative for a long time. And even though real rates have actually risen and the dollar has risen, gold and silver trade pretty well. Because if you take it from here, what happens is, okay, well, the Fed is either going to hike us into recession, which means that they're going to immediately back off and probably start cutting, which would be good for gold and silver, or they're not going to be able to catch up to inflation, and that'll be good for gold, just as it was in the 1970s when they were hiking, just as it was in the mid-2000s when they were hiking. And we all know that gold bottomed in December 2015 when Janet Yellen started hiking for the first time in 7 years, or I should say the first time after having rates zero for 7 years. So I think that, you know, counterintuitively, gold and silver traded poorly last year with high inflation. And this year it's trading great with still high inflation, but rising rates and rising real rates and a rising dollar. But I think that for the reasons I stated, that could be one of the reasons why.
Peter, to that point, do you think there's been a change in the market or perception of the investors that are investing now away from gold, getting distracted by other assets? In turn, almost the shine is off gold because there's a different breed of investors here. And quite frankly, they just don't have that loyalty to the precious metals that some of the older generations do.
I guess that's very possible. But, you know, when you compare the current generation with older ones, you know, gold's been around for 5,000 years. It's a lot of generations. So there are a lot of lessons learned through living 5,000 years.
That's a very good point, Peter. But you know what? There just does seem to be at least a little shift, even in terms of my friends who are a bit younger that just don't seem to care about that sector, even though they see some other sectors that have the same narrative, like cryptos, and they're saying, oh, well, I just like cryptos better, even though they have the same arguments behind them. But to your point, gold has been around a lot longer. Quick question when it comes to the gold mining stocks. I know you don't follow them too closely, but we do need to address the fact that the stocks really have underperformed the underlying gold price. Any thoughts on why that has been the case?
Yeah, they've certainly been dreadful, unfortunately. And I wish I had a good answer. To me, I think it's just total apathy. I mean, these companies are printing money hand over fist, at least those that are producing, with all in sustainable cost of $1,000 to $1,200. So I'm pretty shocked at how poorly they trade, but I don't see that being sustainable if the price of gold and silver trade as well as they do and continue to do so.
Well, just one more on the commodity side of things, Peter. The commodities have had fits and starts. Different ones have run at different times. We saw some big moves in copper, aluminum, iron, nickel, zinc, oil and gas have done great. But with this kind of environment where we still have persistent high inflation, but maybe inflation that's going to start tapering down some, but we also have slowing growth, are there any commodities that have your eye for 2022? Any that you think maybe are a little overheated and may pull back? What's your view of the landscape of the commodities?
So I've been bullish on oil and gas stocks since late 2020. And I do admit that I'm struggling right now with how long to stay in this trade. You know, on one hand, I see all the supply pressures that will keep prices elevated and the lack of investment. You know, politicians still beating up on anybody who produces fossil fuels. But on the other hand, you know, worried about, let's just say we in this synchronized global monetary tightening that we're in, and that slows growth and what that means for the demand side. But then I go back to, okay, well, let's look at China, for example, who is, you know, obviously one of the biggest consumers of oil. What happens if they get off this zero COVID policy or COVID goes away? That economy starts to rebound and recover and people start traveling again and living their life again over there, then that would be a huge demand booster. So I go back and forth. I do think that over the next couple of years, prices will continue to go higher, but I can't discount the possibility of a correction first. I think with agriculture, I'm more confident that prices will stay high. Predicting the demand for food is definitely a bit easier, even though you can obviously produce more crops every year and not have the same supply challenges. But I think that you know, there's still pockets of growth still left in fertilizer stocks, to use that as an example. We know copper is hugely important, and but copper still will be subject to, you know, any lapses in demand over the next year or two, even though the supply side is obviously very tight. So it's I'm trying to balance it because I know that the commodity rally is certainly not in its early stages after the run that we've seen, but I'm not sure how far we are in the game, which I'm still bull, but I don't want to be caught with in a downdraft, if that makes any sense.
Peter, I think that makes perfect sense. This is not a market to be overly aggressive with because of the change in policy, monetary policy, that is, that we are seeing this year. And the fact that the Fed is going to be hiking into most likely a slowing economy. Inflation might be coming down, yes, but also a flattening yield curve. It's very interesting to see how the markets are going to react and what is going to drop fastest, because it does seem like the risk is more to the downside here than markets getting out of hand to the upside. That's just what happens when we do have tighter monetary policy. But Peter, it's great chatting with you, buddy. Always enjoy having you on the show, and I always enjoy reading over your emails and all the other interviews you do on different media sources. You're great to have on our show. I know everyone else appreciates your time. So again, thank you for taking time on this weekend show, and I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate having me on. You too.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Peter Buchvar. Boy, oh boy, we covered a lot. And the look ahead to this year, which is just really has so many question marks around it. But hey, that's going to make it fun to follow along with inflation, central bank policy, and market moves because, well, we definitely saw some more volatility at the tail end of this week. We're switching focus a little bit. We're going to focus in these last two segments a little bit more specifically on the resource sector. And I'm happy to report I am bringing back onto the show Kai Hoffman, CEO of Solar Financial Group. Now, Kai, you and I chat on a fairly regular basis, and you're really my go-to guy when it comes to breaking down some of the summary of financings in the resource sector. That's one thing that I think anyone who follows the sector closely has noticed is that last year, boy, oh boy, a lot of money was raised. Even 2 years ago, there was still a lot of money raised, especially at the tail end of 2020 and then into 2021. But this year, we're still seeing some big deals being announced, but I know a lot of the juniors, or at least some of the juniors, are having trouble raising money, and they're getting a bit tighter with their funding of programs, really anything, because they are seeing the outlook of maybe they won't be able to raise money with the amount of ease that there was in the last about year and a half. Can you give us some insights and compare the financings that we're seeing early on this year, even at the tail end of last year, to that pretty massive financing window that was opened up starting at the tail end of 2020?
Yeah, Corey, fantastic to be back on the program. Thanks for having me. It's been really interesting to see because you mentioned it in your intro. There's a lot of uncertainty in the sector and a volatility. Like volatility, of course, from the main markets. Nobody knows really where it is going. Is the Fed going to hike 25 basis points, 50 basis points? And what is it going to do to the gold price? That really dictates sentiment. And I think we have seen that hesitancy in the last few weeks here, or the beginning of the year, actually, in the junior mining sector as well, because financing have been a bit sluggish. We have seen a couple bigger financings, as you mentioned. Obviously, headline news is the big Osisko development financing this week that's been upsized a couple times, raising $200 million. And if you throw it all in one pot for the year, that's roughly 50%. Of overall financing is just but done by one deal. And that's a bit scary to see. It's good to see that there is money available, but it also means that there's no money available for the smaller companies. And I've been speaking with a lot of companies over the last few weeks, and there's still hesitancy of going actually out to the market and asking for money. So companies, actually the reason for that is multifold. And one of them is they're still waiting for results. They don't know how to plan their year yet, but also that insecurity, that uncertainty in the market, and just the feedback from investors. We don't see it. There's no buying overall in the market yet. Although we see gold exploding today, we're touching 1860 as we're speaking here. I think it'll take a while for that to trickle down in investor sentiment and translate into dollars.
Well, and let's see if this pop in gold at the tail end of this week is simply just geopolitics coming out of Russia and Ukraine. But again, back to the financings here. Have you seen any certain sectors that seem to be leading the way or have garnered a bit more interest from investors, maybe outside of gold, since gold has been so boring for well over a year now?
Yeah, boring is a good is a good word. Yeah, it's sluggish and boring, to be honest. Yeah, the top deal actually so far this year is a lithium deal. It's Rocktech Lithium raising over $52 million, or close to $53 million, and until the Osisko deal was announced, that was 25% of all financings, followed by a copper gold deal, followed by a nickel deal. So that tells you that maybe the investor eyeballs are on other sectors within the commodity space. Gold will have to come back to the spotlight. I think it's trying this week, but battery metals, battery materials are catching a lot of bids right now as well, garnering the attention. If I look at my Twitter feed as well, there's a lot of activity in that space. And it's good to see, like, the sector needs it. We could use a couple more copper financings, to be honest, bigger ones as well. We need more copper mines. But the lithium space, also a lot of graphite deals were done also last year. That is interesting to see personally, because I've been burned in 2015, 2016 by the battery material space. I'm glad to see it take off now. And it seems like the market seems to understand that it's not good to just invest in charging stations. You actually need the materials to build those things as well.
Really does sound like it's all coming around that green movement, though, that is getting a whole new wind behind it, especially when it comes to the financings. Any insights on the smallest companies, though, or some of the real junior exploration companies? We've already touched on it earlier that we've definitely heard from management that they're having trouble raising money, but anything that stands out to you in terms of the lack of interest right now for the smaller exploration plays?
I think we're seeing smaller financings happening, but they're all coming with juicy warrants as well. So companies really have to peacock in that regard. Like, you do have to hand out 5-year warrants. And that's something, like, from a company perspective, you don't want to do, but that shows desperation as well. And you might not be able to raise the full amount. And looking at the valuations of some of the companies and the share price developments, because the sentiment was so bleak, they don't want to raise more than that as well. So they'll try to raise the bare minimum. If they can even raise that. I've seen a lot of tranche closings and tranche financings, meaning like they're opening a financing but have to close in various tranches because it just takes forever to close. And that is something we're witnessing right as well. So we don't see an overall broad market rally in that regard. And the juniors, the smaller end of the spectrum, will have a hard time financing.
Does that have you worried? Because I know that you talk to a lot of juniors. I talk to a lot of juniors as well. And there are a number of companies that have money in the bank and are doing good work. But there's also a lot of companies that are starting to run low on cash. And we've seen how desperate juniors can get before. And unfortunately, when a company's running out of money, it in no way attracts new investors to come in and buy on the open market. So what's your assessment of the overall health of the juniors in the resource space?
It is not too bad. Everybody's been saying, well, with some of the juniors, they just need to die. We need to see more M&A and consolidation. That hasn't happened, obviously. Even in 2015 or 13, 14, the really, really bad years, that consolidation or companies haven't disappeared. They always find a way to finance, raise a couple hundred grand and survive, unfortunately. And we'll see that happening throughout. It won't change. Am I concerned? No, because last year we raised $6.8 billion. That's the second highest amount of money we've raised since 2011, since we started tracking the financings with Orin Inc. And that's exceptional. So I do think companies have a real chance of creating value. And the overall financing, or the average per financing, was actually fairly high as well. It's been over $5 million. So in theory, those dollars should be used for drill programs and studies, technical reports that should create underlying value. So far, the market is not rewarding those companies. But if that happens, I think there's good value to be had in those share prices or in those stocks that have generated that value, meaning they have put out drill results. And we're still seeing those trickle out from last summer. So I don't think we've fully seen that being priced in yet. So there is an opportunity. And if those all are fully reported, I think the sector will do a little better than it is right now. It feels like we're a bit in limbo right now.
Ooh, and the stocks have just vastly underperformed the underlying metals too. And even now, as we're seeing some good drill results come out, the market is not really popping on the back of those. At best, we get kind of a sideways or at least short-term move higher. But if those drill results are disappointing, boy, oh boy, some companies are getting punished. But hey, that's why I've been bringing on so many companies onto the show to try to outline the work that is going on. And one thing that we should bring up too is that you are hosting another SF Online. This is session 11. This is a conference where everyone can tune in online. That's happening February 16th, starting at 6 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Kai, can you give us a little background on who's speaking, some of the keynotes at this conference coming up, please?
Yeah, great pleasure. So we got Brian Lenny of Junior Stock Review and Jeff Clark at goldsilver.com. I had a chance to speak with Jeff just earlier this week, and he's going to touch on M&A activity in the space and to whether the trend is accelerating or not. And I think he's going to have some interesting insights into that because he's looking at, of course, the Great Bear transaction with Kinross, but also like who could be the next M&A target. And we have some companies presenting that might be on that list, or I hope are on his list. I don't know. But we got eight different companies, like from Junior Explorer, just listed early stage greenfield exploration, to Arizona Sonoran, for example, a larger copper explorer in Arizona that just jumped 18% this week based on good, really good drill results. So there's still the possibility in the market to perform well, right? So that is interesting. And it's free to attend, obviously, but at the format is really compact, 15-minute presentations with Q&A. It's a really digestible format from 6 to 9, 3 hours, so it doesn't take all day. And I think you get a whole lot of information punched into you.
All right, Kai. Well, I will post a link within this weekend show posting where everybody can sign up and tune in to that conference. And if you have any questions for Kai regarding the conference, feel free to email me, fleck@kereport.com. Kai, it's great chatting with you. I'm going to bring you back on the show a little bit more regularly just to highlight the financing moves, some of the changes in that financing environment, because it is one of the keys for all investors to understand just how easy or difficult it is for companies to be raising money at the current time. Kai, thanks as always for your time, man. We'll chat again soon. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, Corey. Anytime.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report, and we are wrapping up this weekend's edition with Jayant Bhandari, private investor and consultant to a number of large investors in the resource space. Now, Jayant, we're going to start off high level discussing precious metals stocks. Look, gold continues to hang out right around 1800, mostly above 1800 recently, but we have, I feel like, been talking about 1800 for over a year now for the gold price. And the gold stocks, unfortunately, they continue to lag. We're seeing low volume. We're seeing, at least on GDX and GDXJ, prices continue to test some support areas that, if broken, could drop these stocks even further. Whereas gold, again, right around 1800, not really threatening any significant breakdown when you consider that a lot of strong support levels are much lower. What are you taking away from this continued environment here, Jayant, where the precious metal stocks continue to lag where the gold price stands?
Hi, good morning, Corey. In 2021, I made a loss in my investments. Gold price, in my view, is reasonably good. It refuses to go below $1,800. And at 1830, it is showing signs of strength, in my view. Now, there is a clear lag between the gold price and mining companies. And this lag has to go away at some point of time. And this delta is what I want to exploit right now, which means that I am actually very excited about the current market. I think there is a nice upside in investing at the current time because gold price has done reasonably well compared to what has happened to the junior mining companies. So it's a good opportunity in my view.
And Jayant, when you see the gold price holding up well, or even the silver price holding up well, or we could even say the same thing about copper, it's held up well, but the juniors have, you know, been pressured so much to the downside. Do you think there's a point where generalist investors will start looking at some of the producers that are making good money and can go on acquisitions, and so that may get them excited? Or what do you think may bring the generalist investors in, since the metal prices have held up well, but the stocks really haven't?
Well, Shad, I don't know how generalist investors think about the gold sector. The problem with the big mining companies that which the generalist investor would be interested in tend to be overpriced. They trade at a P/E of, 20 or 30, which is compared to what happens in other sectors is very expensive. So if I were a generalist investor, I would look at these numbers because I do, Shad, look at some companies outside the commodities sector. I realize that big mining companies tend to be unnecessarily expensive. So I would be discouraged from investing in big companies. But then a generalist investor would not be interested in junior mining companies because they are too small. They don't have enough information about these junior mining companies, and the liquidity is very bad in junior mining companies. But again, mining sector is not for everyone. It is only for those people who have a close eye on the sector, who knows the people in the sector and who can identify companies that offer you upside. As we all know, the mining sector in general loses you money for compared to the performance of the underpinning commodities. So as a basket of stocks in the mining sector, I would not invest in it because it loses money for me. I would rather invest in commodities themselves if I were optimistic about commodities. But the only reason I invest in mining sector is because I hope and I think I can identify isolated opportunities that offer me a good upside.
That's saying a lot, Giant, because we keep on asking what's going to bring in the generalists or even the younger investors. And unfortunately, the sector is unloved and tough right now. So when you're losing money, that doesn't draw more people in. Even if they see the underlying metals price go higher, there just seems to be this lack of interest in mining generally. That being said, when you're looking at companies, how important is it for a company to have money right now? And not just money to keep the lights on, but money to do the work that they are saying they're going to do. I ask this because I have noticed some smaller companies having trouble raising money. There still is a lot of money being raised, but boy, oh boy, when a company's low on funds, I've been noticing their share price drifting substantially lower.
Clearly, Corey, you need a company that you want to invest in companies that don't need money right now. This is not the best time to raise money. I think in a month or so, things will have changed quite dramatically. Because if the gold price stays where it is, excitement will return back among the retail investors, who are clearly the most important people in the junior mining space. And if the excitement returns, these share prices will perform very nicely over the next 1 month, assuming gold price stays where it is and goes up a bit higher than where it is. When a company raises money, I want a clear direction on where that money is going to go. That money should go into value creating opportunities, something that I can see happening. We were earlier, before you started recording, talking about a company where we weren't sure whether those tens of millions of dollars were going to generate value for investors, or at least investor did not see how it was generating, all that drilling was generating value for them. So I don't want that scenario. I want a scenario in which my money can show me a creation of value which is higher than the money that is going into the ground. And of course, I don't want too much money going into marketing and corporate G&A. So we should keep an eye on those companies, but I prefer companies that are for now cashed up.
Well, Giant, you're very good at isolating these value arbitrages, whether it's during a takeover where two companies have a literal arbitrage, or just when you're evaluating a development project or ounces in the ground or a company that may be a small producer. How do you do it? What is your general criteria? You know, you've often said you just use your spreadsheet and it tells you when things are undervalued. But what are the key things you're looking for that other investors can learn from you on, Giant?
Well, Shad, there's no science behind it, to be honest. It's just that I keep my eyes open for any opportunity. And if I see an opportunity, if I see a $100 bill lying on the ground, I want to believe that it's $100 bill lying on the ground. I don't want to fool myself into thinking that if there were a $100 bill on the ground, someone would have picked it up anyway. So I want to believe in what I see and then take action accordingly. So if I see value, I invest in those companies, and those values usually are their when companies are unseen, unrecognized, or in fact hated by the market, that's where you can make the most bang for your buck. And that's the kind of companies I'm usually interested in.
John, do you care to share with us a company that you think is either unloved right now or that maybe has one of the brightest upsides that you're seeing? I know it's hard to say because a lot of these stocks have been going down, but any stocks you want to share with us, please?
I can talk about a company which I have a love and hate relationship with. This company is Austral Gold. The ticker in Canada is AGLD. It's trading at 7 cents Canadian. And in Australia, the ticker is AGD. And it's trading at 7.8 cents Australian. Now, this company has a producing mine in Chile, producing between 40 to 45,000 ounces a year at the current rate. The name of the mine is Guanaco Amancaya Mine Complex. It's 100% owned project of the company. My view is that at the current rate, at the current gold price, they should be generating a cash flow of about, a free cash flow after paying all the expenses and taxes of about, I would say, more than 10 million Canadian dollars. The market capitalization of this company is just over 40 million Canadian dollars, which means that within 4 years, the company will have generated enough cash to justify the current market capitalization. On top of that, they are expanding their operations in Chile. And when that happens, the cost of production will go down and the profitability will, of course, go up on the higher production volume. So I think this company offers me a good protection, downside protection. Last year, they paid a dividend of 0.8 cents Australian. So if I buy it at 7.8 cents Australian or a bit lower than that, and actually you can pick it up at a lot lower than 7.8 cents Australian because there are not many bids in this company. You make a 10% dividend if they offer you 0.8 cent Australian in dividend again, and perhaps higher dividend as we go forward. So this is a high dividend paying company, and I think there's a clear 100, in my view, 100% upside in owning this company. The risk of owning this company is that close to 80% of the stocks are held by the management, insiders, and a couple of institutions, which means that the market visibility of this company is close to nil, and the company is very unresponsive. They will not respond to you. They will very likely not bother talking with you because they don't need to. They operate like a private company. But listen, my job is to make money. If I can make 10% a year in dividend yield and get a capital appreciation of 50 to 100%, I will sell my shares and move on. And I think the upside is even higher, but I'm not going to wait for a higher upside. If I can make 100% within the next 1 year or so, I'm going to sell my shares and move on. And that's good enough for me.
Well, Giant, I like your candid response there. And sometimes people get focused on these huge long-term 3 to 5 year plans, but sometimes it's fine to go in and make 50% or 100%, call it a day and move on to another trade. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. I mean, I would suggest that possibly one other risk is that they do have a large percentage of their assets in Chile and then some in Argentina and the U.S. But another hidden upside may be that they did do a transaction where they did a merger with Revelo Resources. And if I remember correctly, Giant, Revelo was a prospect generator and had a number of properties. It looks like they still retain a lot of those properties. Could that be another further upside that the market is not realizing right now?
Absolutely, Shad. So the only thing based on which I have invested in this company is their mining project in Chile, which itself gives me a close to 100% upside based on the current share price. Then you have a proper mine in Argentina, which is in care and maintenance, which might become profitable if gold price goes up a bit more. And they have a 1,500 ton per day processing plant, the camps in Argentina. So that project gives me a free blue upside. And then all the exploration projects that they have, including one advanced exploration project in Argentina, at which I haven't even bothered to look at. They all give me extra upside, and also the projects that you just mentioned that came from Revelo Resources. So those are all extra upside for me. I'm just hoping for 100% upside based on the current share price and based on the producing mine in Chile.
So it really sounds like you are geared more towards the production and the growth of production from this company. But you did mention that they aren't very good at communicating to the market, which could be one of the reasons why they're undervalued now. Do you think in this environment that a company can be found and pushed higher simply on the back of a bit better production, even though they're not telling the market, not getting in front of investors?
Well, unfortunately for a company like this, what will move the share price up is cash coming out of the mines. If they give a 0.8% dividend, and if investors, the 20% retail investors who are watching this company, see that this production is making a good cash flow, the share price will just go up because they will see a higher dividend coming in the future. And that's the only way it will go up. The problem is, as I said again, the company is mostly operating as a private company and they won't bother telling their story to the market. Why should they stay as a public company? I don't know. But while all this is happening, while they are unseen, unappreciated, and even hated by the market, if I can make a 50 to 100% upside on my current investment, I'm happy with that.
Fair enough. I was even going to ask you about that final point, but hey, you are correct in the sense that it is seeming to be run kind of like a private company, but some interesting production growth, I guess, and just underlying production that the company has. So, hey, Giant, good chatting with you. We'll wrap it up here, but I do appreciate you taking some time on this weekend show. I'm sure we'll be chatting in another couple weeks. And hey, hopefully Astral Gold does get that revaluation that you're looking for. And hopefully broadly, we see some more investors in the precious metals space when it comes to the stocks. Giant, thank you again for joining us this weekend. And everybody, thank you for tuning in to this weekend show. Please keep in touch with Chad and I through email. Our email addresses are fleck@kereport.com and chad@kereport.com. We love hearing from each and every one of you. Giant, everyone else, have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.